Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring Yamilet Rodriguez, a 2019 recipient of a James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award. Watch a video about her work at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, February 12th, 2019, and you're listening to Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news and culture magazine. I'm your co-host, Laura Satsui, and I'm here with Monica Velez.
Today on our show, we look at how the bankruptcy filing from utility provider PG&E could derail the state's renewable energy goals.
And later, we hear from storytellers who offer a personal take on civil injustice.
But first, almonds are a huge industry here in the San Joaquin Valley. But without honeybees to pollinate the trees, there would be no harvest. By some estimates, as much as 90% of the country's bees are trucked to California for the almond bloom. In 2014, however, beekeepers nationwide reported that almost half of all honeybee colonies had collapsed, a terrifying time for growers. But one recent study is helping to untangle the mystery, and thanks to an industry partnership, it's already changing how the crop is managed. FM 89's Carrie Klein spoke with Reed Johnson, the senior author on the study and an entomologist at The Ohio State University.
Honeybees have been having a hard time, probably for at least the last decade, probably maybe even the last couple decades. And it's not that people can't keep bees. It's like the difficulty level on keeping bees alive has just gotten turned way up. And it's just much more challenging than it used to be. And that's because of varroa mites, which is this parasitic mite that sucks the bee's fat body and transmits viruses between different bee populations, is a culprit number one in probably a lot of the problems bees are facing. But that's not to let pesticides off the hook. And so then I set out to test the different insecticides and fungicides that are applied to almonds during bloom when the bees are present there to see if any of them alone or in combination could cause the kind of symptoms that the beekeepers were reporting, the harm to their colonies. And what we found is that the one insecticide is harmful to developing bees, really regardless of whatever its tank mixed with. But in another case, we found an insecticide that is safe for bees, both adult and larval bees, but when it's tank mixed with a fungicide and applied at the same time, it's likely that it can kill both adult bees and larval bees.
Now, there has been some other research on, you know, common insecticides or pesticides in general on, you know, their impact on honeybees. You know, what led you to believe that that might not be the full story, that you might want to look at combinations of chemicals rather than just each one individually?
Well, I mean, almonds is a really interesting situation because everything that goes on almonds, none of it is, you know, known to be that toxic to bees. Otherwise, it wouldn't be applied to almonds during bloom. I mean, The growers are paying a lot of money to bring in these bees, and they don't want to do anything that they think would harm them. So, I mean, they were applying these things with good intentions. It didn't say anything on the label that it was going to harm the bees. And that kind of led me to suspect that there might be some interaction going on here, because it's quite common to save on labor costs and the carbon emissions of driving a sprayer through the field. They can just combine an insecticide and a fungicide in a tank mix and save all that application cost and put them both on at the same time. And I suspected that that's actually a fairly common practice, and I suspected that that might be the root cause of the problems beekeepers were seeing.
Right, and so you decided to expose these bees, both adults and their larvae, to a number of common insecticides and fungicides. Tell me a little bit more what you found.
The one that kills larvae specifically, and this is regardless of what fungicide it's tank mixed with, is called dimelin. And this is a classic insect growth regulator kind of insecticide in that it doesn't kill insects like immediately. It only kills developing insects because the chitin that it's inhibiting the synthesis of is what makes up the insect's exoskeleton. And so it kills developing insects because adult insects don't need to develop a new exoskeleton. They already have one. So it only is effective against like caterpillars or grubs or apparently larval bees as well. The other insecticide-fungicide combination was the insecticide called Alticor. And this is a new class of insecticides that targets insect muscle action. And it can be very effective against, you know, many insect pests, and it has a really good bee safety profile. It doesn't appear to harm bees at all, larvae or adults, when applied alone. But in combination with a fungicide called Tilt or propiconazole, what we think is happening is that fungicide is inhibiting the ability of the bees to break down that insecticide. And just like when we take a drug, that drug is safe for us because we're able to break it down and metabolize it. But if you take too much, you get an overdose and you could be in trouble. And we think what's happening is this fungicide is essentially causing the bees to overdose on this insecticide. They can't break it down and metabolize it like they normally would, and they become poisoned as a result.
And I imagine that almonds are not the only crop where that occurs, right? I mean, is it possible that combinations and interactions of these pesticides for other crops could also be impacting honeybee populations?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's quite common that things are applied in a tank mix because there are a lot of advantages to do that from the applicator's perspective. And unfortunately, none of these pesticides are tested in combination with each other as part of their registration with the US EPA to make sure that they're not outright dangerous for pollinators.
And so this is one study, you know, one piece of research. You know, what do you think should come next? I mean, what do you think are the next steps here? And should the agricultural community be making any changes based on what you found?
Well, I think the big change that can be made is to not apply insecticides during bloom. And even if it's claimed to be safe, I mean, there could be the potential for interactions there. And I mean, I'm based in Ohio, so I'm not an expert on almond agriculture, but I know that there are other opportunities to control insect pests before bloom or after bloom when the bees are not present. As to what's next, well, we only looked at a fairly short list of the fungicides, and the pesticide world is constantly changing with new products coming on and old products going away. So we actually have some work to do in testing the next round of fungicides, as well as some of the adjuvants. These are compounds that can increase the rainfastness or the penetration of a pesticide application, looking at the interaction between those adjuvants and the fungicides and insecticides to see if the presence of those in the tank mix makes the whole combination more toxic to bees or not.
Okay, well, Reed Johnson, entomologist at The Ohio State University, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks a lot.
Now, Carrie, we said that this research had a connection with industry. What does that mean?
Yeah, it does. And that's one thing that I think actually makes this research really stand out. Studies like this often get stuck in academia. You know, they make recommendations to a particular industry, and then it becomes difficult to actually get an audience with that industry and go about making changes. But this study was actually partially funded by the Almond Board of California. So I spoke with Bob Curtis, who's a pollination consultant and the Almond Board's former director of agricultural affairs. He says they've been working with Reed Johnson and his team for years, and this research has already influenced the best practices the board offers to its growers. Here's Curtis.
Our recommendation there is do not apply insecticides during bloom. There's one exception to that. There's an organic-based insecticide that we know is totally safe for adult bees and larvae. And we can say that because there are alternative timings during the year that you can apply insecticides effectively against your target pests. In the area of fungicides, which Reed has also been working in, our recommendation is to apply the fungicides in the afternoon or the evening when the bees and the pollen are not present.
All right, so there's been a change in recommendations for best practices, but has that actually translated to a change in real life?
Curtis says yes, and they determined that by combing through pesticide use reports made available by the state of California.
And we track that, and there's, again, has been a substantial drop in the insecticides applied during bloom, and those that are applied again are the ones that are more favorable for bee health.
Great, Carrie. Thanks for chatting.
Thank you.
Pacific Gas and Electric, the primary utility provider in the Central Valley, filed for bankruptcy last month. The company is on the hook for liability over many of the state's wildfires last year. Beyond PG&E's financial problems, however, is the question of what this means for the renewable energy industry. It contracts with PG&E and the state's goal to rely on 100% clean energy by 2045. To find out more, I caught up with Lauren Summer, who covers science for member station KQED. Lauren, thank you so much for being with us, first of all.
Hi, thanks.
So you've been doing some reporting on how PG&E's bankruptcy declaration would affect the state's renewable energy. But let's back up for a second. How does this even work? You know, does PG&E even generate solar energy itself?
Yeah, the way it works is, you know, a long time ago now, more than a decade ago, California passed laws that required more renewable energy be put on the grid. And this was back when solar energy in particular was pretty expensive. It was kind of still the early days. But those laws and, you know, governor after governor, this is Governor Schwarzenegger back then, would get up and say, we want to see more renewables. The responsibility actually falls to electric utilities like PG&E. So when those laws were passed, PG&E had to go out and sign a lot of contracts with solar power providers and wind power providers to actually get that energy onto the grid.
Gotcha. Okay, so it's they have contracts with other solar providers. That's how it works. And so I know the state has some pretty ambitious goals regarding renewable energy, most recently SB 100, which says that 100% of the state's electricity has to come from renewable or emissions-free sources by 2045. And so how does or how would bankruptcy throw a wrench in all of those plans for the state?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is no one's really sure yet, and that's why people are getting a little bit nervous. A bankruptcy judge has a lot of power. And so in this bankruptcy proceeding, the judge is going to have to be looking at, well, who does PG&E owe money to? And then they have to figure out who should they pay and in what order. And so obviously these solar power and wind power renewable energy companies are some of those entities that PG&E owes money to through these contracts. And when PG&E signed these contracts, I mean, they're for 15 or 20 years at a time, but they're agreeing to buy some of this electricity from them. So the nervousness from the renewable energy companies comes from the fact that a judge could look at them and say, I will pay you 50 cents on the dollar, or maybe let's just renegotiate some of these contracts. And no one's really sure, but it's really been enough to send some ripples through that industry.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of discretion from a judge. And so what, if anything, can renewable energy companies do to protect themselves?
Yeah, you know, in this case, it's gotten kind of interesting. We've seen, you know, right after this happened, a handful of renewable energy projects had their credit ratings downgraded because of their link with PG&E. And, you know, no business wants to see that. And so we've seen a couple of renewable energy companies kind of go on the offensive a little bit. You know, instead of just kind of waiting to see what a bankruptcy judge would decide, they actually went to the federal government, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to try to get them involved. They said, you know, hey, you've got jurisdiction over some of these interstate power contracts and power agreements. So we want you to intervene in this case and say that the federal government should have to approve any changes to these power contracts. So kind of they were looking to get someone else involved in the fight to maybe protect them slightly. And what we probably are going to see is just a very big jurisdictional fight between this bankruptcy judge, between the federal government. And then, of course, the state has another big stake in this whole proceeding as well.
Wow. And while this is all playing out with the bankruptcy proceedings, I think maybe we should note that consumers who have PG&E, which is a lot of the Central Valley, you know, it's not like we're going to lose power. This really impacts the way the company will operate. And like you said, the state's ability to move forward with renewable energy. But turning from electricity and gas to a different natural resource, I also wanted to ask you about water. So last week, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation came out with a new biological opinion regarding the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project, which essentially provide water to farmers and municipalities in the Central Valley and also other parts of the state. But they haven't done that in a long time, so this is pretty significant, but it's also a huge document. So I don't know, big picture view here, what could a new biological opinion mean? What's in there?
Yeah, I know this sounds very complicated and wonky, but it's actually incredibly, incredibly important. And I'll tell you why. You know, people hear a lot about fish versus farms, right? We kind of see signs around all over the place, and there's a lot of contention. Most of the time, what people are talking about when they say that is these environmental rules in the Delta that are meant to protect endangered salmon and endangered Delta smelt. And the way those rules work currently is that sometimes of year, in some years, they limit the amount of water that can be pumped out of the Delta in order to protect those fish, essentially, you know, to prevent killing them. Mm. And the idea is to prevent them from going completely extinct. You know, these are the biological opinions. That's what these rules are. The last time that they were written was in 2008 and 2009. They were incredibly controversial. The litigation dragged on and on and on because so many people were fighting over them. And for good reason. I mean, there's a lot of water at stake here. There's people's jobs at stake. There's, you know, the future of endangered species at stake. And so now we are seeing the next version being written. And the controversy, of course, is very intense all over again.
And so I guess what could be the impacts ultimately? Might it mean that farmers get less water? I understand that, you know, because protecting a lot of these fish and certain endangered species has to do with lawsuits. So they kind of have to do the bare minimum to keep those going along, as far as I know. But is that like ultimately what could happen, is just municipalities and farmers get the short end of the stick or not?
Well, this time around, it's a little bit different. You know, okay. When President Trump came to the Central Valley when he was campaigning, you know, he promised more water for agriculture, right? And we've seen, you know, some other memorandums written trying to ordering the Interior Department to maximize water supplies. You know, we haven't actually seen those things happen. But this might be the first instance where we actually see them acting on that promise, which is what came out is from the Bureau of Reclamation. Basically, it's their proposal for how these environmental rules will work. And they are proposing to increase water deliveries through the two big water projects, the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project. This is just their proposal, though. And what happens now is that the federal wildlife agencies, which is the Fish and Wildlife Service and then the National Marine Fisheries Service, take what the Bureau of Reclamation has proposed, and they're going to write their versions for the final biological opinions, the final environmental rules. So we won't really know until we actually see those final documents. But certainly what we've seen from this first document is that the Department of the Interior is trying to maybe fulfill that promise that the president made.
And we also know that the Department of Interior is now headed by someone from the Valley, from Westlands Water District. So that might, I guess, affect things as well. Sorry.
People are really certainly looking for that, right? Because they know that there's been a close connection between who's, you know, the acting secretary, David Bernhardt, right? And he was a lobbyist for Westlands Water District. And so I think there are a lot of people that are really keeping their eye on, do we see something from that relationship?
Right. And you mentioned the last time a biological opinion came out, it took a long time. And so I guess, how long are we talking here before some sort of a decision gets made with this one? Do you think it'll be years or just months, or what might that look like?
So the final biological opinions are supposed to come out 135 days from when the Bureau of Reclamation released it recently. And that actually comes from the top. I mean, President Trump sent out a memorandum in the fall ordering that it happen in 135 days. But that's very fast, actually, for a decision of this caliber. I mean, the one we just saw from the Bureau of Reclamation, what I think is like over 3,000 pages, and I don't think I've even opened every document that was part of it. So they're definitely trying to move this along quickly. There's concern from environmental groups that is not enough time to wade through the very complex science and the very complex decision making that has to go on with this. So it's definitely going to happen quickly. And then that's maybe when the lawsuits would start, and then who knows how long that would take.
Wow. And I'm sure as all of this happens, we will keep looking to you for your reporting on it. Lauren Sommer, science reporter at KQED, thank you so much for speaking with us.
No problem. Thanks.
If you or a loved one needed to go to the emergency room, how would you pay the bill? If you're like most Americans, you don't have huge cash funds stowed away for a trip to the ER. Most of us are overwhelmed by the high cost of healthcare, and it doesn't help that medical costs are often hidden. We recently reported on a new federal law that aims to increase price transparency, but doesn't quite hit the mark. California, though, is ahead of the game, and it means we can actually compare prices at local hospitals around the valley. Here to talk about it with me is FM89 reporter Carrie Klein.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, Carrie. So before we get into pricing, remind us again what has been happening lately in terms of transparency.
So the newsiest change is that there's this new federal law that you mentioned that requires hospitals to post their price lists on their websites. And these lists are called charge masters, where hospitals list every single procedure and drug and device they offer along with a price. We reported on this last month. I interviewed a patient advocate about the ins and outs of the law, and it's not really all that momentous. Hospitals don't have to follow any sort of template with this charge master, which may sound kind of nitpicky, but it actually means the lists may be absolutely incomprehensible.
Oof.
Full of tens of thousands of different terms, many of which are just written as acronyms that only hospital workers will understand. So in that and many other ways, this federal law really falls short. The good news for patients, though, is that here in California, we've actually made greater strides toward hospital pricing transparency.
All right, then. So for us living in California, what's the state doing that differs from the federal government?
So we've had one state law in particular on the books here that's made these charge masters available to the public for over a decade. And then on top of that, each hospital also has to publish a form listing the prices of their top 25 or so most common procedures. And it's the same form for each hospital with procedure names in human terms, all formatted the same way. So it does allow a kind of apples to apples comparison between hospitals. There are still many caveats to these, the main one being that these are basically the sticker prices for these procedures that most patients won't actually pay, but we'll get into that in a few minutes.
All right. So I know you looked at this, as you call it, apples to apples comparison between local hospitals here in the San Joaquin Valley. What did you find when it comes to specific procedures?
Right. Well, so first off, there is a huge variation among local hospitals, even for very basic procedures. For instance, say you need to go to the ER and whatever it is isn't life threatening, they might code it as a low to moderate severity issue. That could cost anywhere from $276 at Delano Regional to almost $1,300 at Kern Medical. That's for the exact same ER visit, exact same code. Or say you were to get a comprehensive metabolic panel. That's a series of blood tests that examine all sorts of things like blood sugar, electrolyte levels, kidney function. It's part of a yearly checkup for many people. That one has a huge price range from $45 at Kern Medical to over $800 at Mercy Hospital in Bakersfield.
Wow. That seems like a lot of variation among hospitals for, like you said, certain procedures. But is there a trend where one facility consistently lists their procedures as more expensive than another facility?
Well, when it comes to these sticker prices and these most common procedures, definitely. Almost across the board, the hospitals associated with Dignity Health have the highest prices in the valley. And that includes Mercy Medical Centers and Merced and Bakersfield Memorial Hospital. Some of the lowest prices, though, Delano Regional Medical Center and Madera Community Hospital. There's even a huge variety within some hospital systems. For instance, Adventist Health Centers in Hanford and Reedley have nearly identical prices, but the new one in Tehachapi has lower ER rates, but higher prices for almost everything else. And then there's Kern Medical, which is not part of one of these larger companies. It has a relatively high ER price, but extremely cheap blood tests. So there is tremendous variety in pricing between local hospitals. And if we had the luxury of choosing which ones would be considered in-network, it might be worthwhile to actually check these price lists out.
But of course, one caveat you already mentioned is that these are only sticker prices. So what does that mean in the context of what someone might actually pay?
Basically, what it means is that no one will ever pay as high as what's on those charge masters. Here's Jan Emerson Shea with the California Hospital Association.
And the reason for that is that what you as a patient pay is based on what your insurance coverage is. So, for example, if you are a person who has an HMO health insurance product, you likely pay a flat copayment when you go to see your physician. And if you are admitted to the hospital, you may pay a small copayment or nothing at all, depending on what your arrangement is. If you have a different type of insurance plan, maybe it's a PPO or a high deductible plan, those plans call for different types of payment arrangements on behalf of the person being treated.
So essentially, those sticker prices may be a starting point, but what you pay is really a result of backdoor negotiations between your provider and your insurer.
But what if you don't have insurance?
Even then, you're not likely to pay these sticker prices either. Here's Jan Emerson Shea again.
Anybody who is uninsured will either receive their care free of charge or at a discounted rate based on their particular income situation. And the discount amount is determined not based on these charge master prices, but it's determined based on what either Medicare would pay the hospital for the same service, what a health plan would pay for the hospital, or what a workers' comp situation would pay the hospital.
So does that mean that patients have no control whatsoever over what they pay?
Not exactly. There's still some wiggle room if you think you've been overcharged. For instance, if you're uninsured and low income, call the hospital's billing offices and ask to talk to them about charity care. Or talk about that sliding scale you should be on if you make less than 3 times the federal poverty level. Even if you are insured, you can still call a hospital's billing office or your insurance to try to negotiate, and sometimes a harsh spotlight can help. Media outlets like Kaiser Health News and Vox have highlighted some really absurd hospital charges around the country, and in a few cases, hospitals have balked and brought down their charges.
Very interesting. Thanks so much, Carrie.
Thank you.
Last week, we spoke with writers Nikiko Masumoto and Brin Saito about their Yonsei Memory Project. For the past several months, they've been working with artists, teachers, and others on how to tell personal stories about social injustice in front of an audience. It's all part of a greater effort to get people talking about civil liberty struggles going back to the Japanese-American incarceration during World War II. Well, the storytellers shared their work at Fresno State on Saturday, and now we'd like to play some excerpts. We'll start with one called Expectations. In this story, Cindy Vang has just learned that her third child is going to be a girl. She's already the mother of 2 boys, and she wonders how she will raise a strong woman in the patriarchal Hmong culture.
How do I raise you in a community that values males and living in a society where women have to fight so much more than their male counterparts to make their voices heard? How might I go about teaching you that the world is a safe and accepting space? And how would I help you have hope and see the positivity in a scary, dark, and confusing time? Across social media, women were posting hashtag #HeAssaultedMeToo. Actresses wore black to the Golden Globes to send the message that time's up, we will be silent with harassment no more. Hmong female victims of domestic violence and patriarchy oppression were uniting with We Will No Longer O Xian Dei. And young Hmong women were debating whether or not bride prices determined their self-worth. How do I build within you the deep appreciation for your sex, your gender, your culture and heritage, the papers that had been given to you? It wasn't too long ago when my mother lied on her deathbed and asked her children to give her pen and paper when she passes so that she may ask to reincarnate as a boy. So that she can go to school like her brothers, because that was the one thing she always wished for. How do I protect you but let you grow? Because of all things, that is what you were born to do. In November 2018, I welcomed my girl into the world. I've learned in the last 2 months that I can't avoid pink. That I think my daughter looks pretty cute with bows and flowers in her hair. And that I still don't have the answers to my questions. But my Mingantai, oh, I will tell you this. I am your mother. Guyakana. And I'm here too. And you're going to stumble and fall. You're going to skin your knees. Your heart is going to break. The world may be cruel. Men and boys might hurt you. Girls might bully you. And you may still be having to fight for everything you deserve. But big girl, I will show you how to survive, how to live, how to love everything that you are, and how to have hope.
In this second story, called The Wall Between, we hear from Will Freeney. He and his son have had a rocky past. The divide between their political and moral values is deep. But Will says his son is still his son, and reconciliation is hard work.
I did not begin drinking seriously until after his mother and I divorced. He, on the other hand, started drinking in junior high or high school, a decade after I had last seen him. Our reunion was actually the result of his drinking. Just 2 weeks after his 20th birthday, he crashed his motorcycle into his cousin's Camaro, breaking 15 bones. Days later, in the hospital, he asked the responding officer why he hadn't written him up for drunk driving and reckless driving. The officer said, "I didn't think you'd live long enough for it to matter." That was when I decided to end the "I'll wait until he decides to find me" approach to reunion and reconciliation. The reunion is now almost 20 years in the past. The reconciliation is a work in progress. Progress is sometimes slow. Outside our relationship, progress is the wall that divides us. Progress is for him an evil encroachment, a conceptual alien horde, whittling away at his white privilege. The government telling him he needs to treat everyone not like him and his with equal rights and equal respect. White privilege is the wall whose construction began over 400 years ago, invisible but impenetrable. It has been extended and reinforced ever since. It is built of exclusion. My son touts his philosophy as one of rugged individualism, but it only pertains to those individuals he deigns to include. For me, that inclusion should be universal, including even him and his, just not letting them make the rules anymore for everyone else. Progress, for me, is inscribed in the legislative and judicial touchstones, like Brown versus Board of Education, the Civil Rights Act of 1965, Roe versus Wade. But it was inscribed there by the unstinting efforts of people, we the people, organized by like minds to create progress. Progress for my son and I lies beyond the horizon, and somehow spanning that chasm regarding the nature of progress, the function of government, the definition of society. Or we may arrive at that point involuntarily. In 2044, when the U.S. Census Bureau projects that over 50% of the U.S. population will consist of minorities, that, I think, may be the real cause of hysteria about the wall, the border. White, Eurocentric society is doomed. However, insincere the promises written on the Statue of Liberty may have been or become, they have underwritten an inevitability. Whether the wall is built of concrete, steel, or bulletproof glass, or not built at all, the wall of white supremacy and privilege on which it is predicated will crumble. I hope I'm alive to see it. I hope my son is too. I hope we are still talking to each other.
And finally, we hear from Anjali Kapoor Davis. She tells the story of the racism she experienced in kindergarten as a young girl from India.
I thought about Michael and Jonathan, my only friends. Michael stuck out because he was too white. Not albino, but close enough. John stuck out because he was black. Me, I was the only brown girl. The other kids called John and I the N-word. He told me what it meant. How many times had he heard it? I was 5 and I was dealing with this level of racism. How could 5-year-olds know what it meant and use it so effectively? 5-year-olds can't be racist, right? This was taught to them by their parents and grandparents. Wow, that's a hell of a family tradition, a heritage of hate. Why didn't the teacher stop it? I couldn't answer that question, but I knew my mom would have more pieces to the puzzle, so I headed to my parents' house next. What do you remember about my kindergarten teacher? I asked her over a cup of chai. I remember when she called me and said that you needed to be in a different class, that you were slow. Retarded was the word they used back then. She jumped to a lot of wrong conclusions. My mom went on to tell how the teacher had been asking about different animals. Where do you see a dog? Where do you see a monkey? I answered the one about the monkeys with, in the garden, which led to a lot of laughter from the class. But monkeys were in the garden in my home for the past few years in India. I also said the camel brought milk to our house, which it did with the guy riding it, in India. So for those reasons, she thought I had a mental deficit. With that mindset, the teacher wasn't going to be any help on the playground either. My mom gave the teacher a piece of her mind on the phone, and after a re-education by my mother, the teacher did invite her to come to the classroom for a show and tell about India. My mom brought clothes, cooking utensils, and handicrafts, as well as a map of India to show where it was located. Smart lady, my mom. I realized I had some work to do myself.
And we should tell you the rest of Anjali's story. She wanted to make sure her own son didn't have such negative experiences, so she followed her mother's lead and introduced her son's kindergarten class to some of the cultures and traditions of India, including Diwali. And we should note that the Yonsei Memory Project is also doing a Day of Remembrance this Saturday, with a memory bus ride honoring the history of Japanese Americans. For more information, you can go to yonseimemoryproject.com.
Self-Help Graphics and Art is an organization in East Los Angeles that intersects art and social justice. The group is celebrating its legacy of producing art prints by Latinx, Chicana, and Chicano artists with an exhibit called Entra, Tinta y Lucha, 45 Years of Self-Help Graphics and Art. For about a month, CSU Bakersfield's Todd Madigan Gallery will house more than 50 art prints from the exhibit. It's inspired by the Chicano movement in the late 1960s and the rise of printmaking as an art form. The gallery director, Jedediah Caesar, showed me some of the work.
You are in the Todd Madigan Gallery on the CSUB campus. It's about 1,000-foot square foot gallery space, white walls, concrete floors, very much in the kind of mode of a contemporary art space, which is what we are. It's roughly broken into two rooms with a kind of longer open hallway space. And what we have here are 54 pieces from the archives of self-help graphics in Los Angeles.
And what makes this special compared to some of the other exhibits that you guys had?
Well, this is a survey of 45 years of work that's been done at this space, which started as a community-centered space for art. They really mainly work in serigraph, which is another name for what's sort of more commonly known as screen printing. This show, which originated at Cal State Los Angeles and was curated by two professors there, with self-help graphics and with some of the artists in the show, it's meant to kind of give a picture of what has evolved over all these years of that space and the work they've done in this community of artists.
Just looking around in this room right now, it seems like there's a lot of like vibrant colors being used.
Yeah, I mean, I think that partially, you know, is partially because, you know, in this process of printing, you can make these incredible vibrant colors happen. You know, you think about screen printing, you think of these, you know, sort of one layer on top of another, really punchy graphic works. Some of them are, because they're so sort of skillfully made, they kind of have the soft elegance of paintings, but you do, yeah, generally see they're really, really graphic. And that's one of the marks of the work in general, is it's like incredible strong graphic sensibility. You know, this works, here's an interesting work to look at in that way by Barbara Carrasco called Dolores. It's a picture of Dolores Huerta. I mean, it can almost double as a political poster. That's how kind of like strong and graphic it is.
And you mentioned before kind of, you know, how some of these are so well done, it almost looks like it is a painting.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm noticing this one over here, like just, here it looks like it's acrylic painting or something.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously it's graphics, but.
Yeah, where it gets really interesting. Like you think you sort of know the medium here, but actually, you know, you're seeing between the artists and the sort of printers and the whole organization, you're seeing this is really getting pushed and people trying to do new things, I think, with it, you know, with this medium.
Can you describe what this looks like?
By John Valadez. Yeah, it's called Chicano Heaven, and it is this, it's just sort of, wow, describing what it is. It's this sort of swirl of almost red clouds and blue, and this group of men sort of watching, but kind of blending up into this space that feels like it's really a kind of furious, fiery space. And then there's a sort of figure off, sort of going deep into this cloud space. And, you know, it's one of those pieces that has like this whole sort of sense of a world, a whole language of allegory.
I also spoke with the executive director of Self-Help Graphics and Art. Betty Avila tells us more about the history behind this exhibit.
The background for this exhibition and how it all really came together was, it's sort of twofold, wanting to bring self-help graphics to the Cal State LA students. Self-help and Cal State LA in many ways serve the same community. There's a lot of overlap in terms of the youth that we want to reach out to, and to call out a number of elements that really define the printmaking experience at self-help. And so that includes things like the technical elements of the process of printmaking, ideas of identity and either challenging or establishing or reaffirming different types of identity. You know, for example, we go into queerness in printmaking, challenging the binary. We dig a little bit into what we call maestras, so the women who have come through the print studio and have really been able to master the medium in a way that is powerful technically. It's innovative and powerful in terms of content. So I think we really wanted to elevate the printmaking studio and that impact within the Chicano art movement, within the Chicano movement more broadly, and really at a national and international level. I mean, these prints have been shown all over the world and are a critical part of Chicano history. But this was really an opportunity for us to zero in on the incredible impact of 45 years of printmaking.
And why do you think it's important to bring this to different people? And why do you think that Bakersfield was an important place for this exhibit to come to?
For a lot of folks who have not had a space like this growing up, or it just hasn't been part of their life, even if they did live in LA or on the East Side, there's always such a sense of empowerment in seeing yourself and seeing your culture, your practices on the wall, and to be in a place of cultural production that reflects you. And so, again, going back to one of the reasons that we really wanted to do this is to make sure that the students of Cal State LA are aware of this history, and all the more reason to take it to a place like Cal State Bakersfield, where it is predominantly Latino student body, and they may or may not have a space like this or even exposure to art like this that reflects them. I'm hoping that it becomes a source of empowerment for people who get to experience the show.
You know, like you said earlier, this is works from a period of or a span of over 45 years. And is there anything that you've like, is there like a common thread or things that some of the works kind of have in common, even though maybe some were, you know, made a really long time ago?
You'll find so many different threads within the exhibition. I think there's definitely a sense of, and you'll see this over time, there's people either sort of carving out a space for themselves or for their community and doing so through their print, or they're touching on a specific social justice issue. And what I've always appreciated about the studio is that the work is just so different. There's such a variety of styles and approaches. We'll have, you know, really explicit social justice related pieces, and then you have pieces that totally address an issue but do it in a very subtle way. It's also incredible to see, I think, how some artists have had the opportunity to grow and really hone in on their printmaking skill, and you see that over time as well. I think especially if you're looking at the earlier years at self-help and you get to a print, you know, like a Wayne Healy print that has just an incredible amount of technical expertise that has to go into it.
And finally this week, we spoke to Megan Anderson Bohegian. She's been a teacher and writer for years, but only started publishing her own work after she retired in 2012. Her latest collection of poems is called Vanishing Point, and in it, she uses metaphors about nature to describe real life. I asked Megan where the inspiration to write about her life and memories in this way comes from, and here's what she shared with me.
It comes from play with words. And when we're really engaged in play, up comes subject matter. So often the best poems are poems that emerge rather than ones that are sort of manipulated, right? to sit down and say, I'm going to write about this moment, the poem is going to pull a trick on you almost always, and it'll come to be about something else. So play. I play with language, and out comes poems.
Can you give us an example? What's maybe a poem that started as one thing and ended up as something
else? There's a poem in here called Faulting, which is a really good example of that. I got kind of obsessed with the word fault because it has so many meanings. And my initial idea was to write about denying being at fault, refusing to accept the responsibility for being at fault. But when I began writing, it changed. Would you like to hear that poem?
Yes, I would love to.
Okay, this is called Faulting. Is it relevant to speak of damage? Our battered containers weakened and straining to hold us. Line scored and crazed by veins that run blue beneath our skin? Does it matter how fault lines slip and shove through our lives, driven by energies not our own? Should we still be surprised by such fractures and the masses of rubble they displace to be compacted, smashed, and thrown aside? Can we claim astonishment at the thrusting up of fault-lined scarp or the valley eroding beside it? Before we hear a thing, our innards know the earth is quaking. Disequilibrium and vertigo precede the rumble, swinging lights and cracks that zigzag up through mortar, tumbling bricks. First comes the shift inside. One fault moves against another. Down where rock sings with rock, the heat of friction is birthing something new.
That was lovely. Thank you. I know you've taught writing for all ages before, grade school, but also college, and you've been really involved with the Fresno poetry community, so organizing readings, helping select the city's poet laureate. Not to deviate too much from talking about your poetry, but how do you set that agenda or direction of the poetry community in the first place? Like, what do you, I don't know, how do you come together and say, here's what we think we want to do?
Well, first of all, I don't set an agenda. I just feel honored to be part of such a generous and inclusive and diverse group of poets as we have here in Fresno. It's an amazing place to be writing poetry. And we have receptive audiences here for poetry, which is wonderful, too. So I'm not an agenda setter, but I do think that poetry needs to be out there where people get a chance to hear it and experience it and hopefully develop their own voice. I think the writing of poetry is kind of an innate quality that humans have. I'd like to have poetry jukeboxes on every corner, really.
So, and I know you're also involved in setting the program for the San Joaquin River Parkway Conservancy and Trust's Respite by the River series. It's a series that features local writers and musicians. And we should note Valley Public Radio is a sponsor of Respite by the River. But you've been involved with that for about five seasons. And your last collection of poems, Sightlines, came out in 2013. So did those kind of coincide, your publishing and you being involved in Respite by the
River?
Well,
I retired in 2012.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, a whole lot of doors opened up for me, including the publication of my first book and being invited to join the committee that organizes Respite by the River. I have an MFA from Fresno State in creative writing, so I'm connected with a lot of people there as well as in the mainstream poetry community, which is not related to the university in any way. So I was a good person to kind of hunt up writers and hopefully to bring in writers that that particular audience, which is an audience of active environmentalists mainly, these might not be writers that they would otherwise come across. So
did you only start writing poetry when you retired, or was that when you started focusing? Yeah, have you always been a poet? Can you talk a little bit about
I have always been a poet. I was lucky to have two cousins who were poets when I was growing up. And one of them actually lived with my family for a while when he was a college student. So I saw this making of poems as something that was fun and something that was enjoyable. I mean, just enjoyable, not to do it for pleasure, not so much to impress anybody. It wasn't schoolwork. It was my own work. So I started it as a child, and I've always written. I was a journalist. I've done lots of other kinds of writing and professional writing, but poetry is my great love.
I was wondering if you could read a poem for us from your book. You mentioned you have one that seems very representative of sort of, you called it Fresno poetry.
Yes, and Fresno poetry has very specific characteristics. Just really quickly, it tends to be grammatical. There's nothing in the way the poem's constructed that's designed to confound a reader. They're anchored in imagery of the natural world, and particularly our own landscape and our own area. And and they're image-based poems as opposed to just language-based poems. And this is a poem that's based on an actual thing. My husband's a biologist and leads hikes all over the place, and he brought back a rattlesnake skin to our house. And this poem is what came out of this snake skin. It's called On the Rattlesnake Skin My Husband Found. Scales curve like baby's fingernails on its diamond head that points down, an arrow aiming toward earth. Back and front are fused as if the skin's been ironed into a cornstalk, rattles stacked kernels tacked to the kitchen wall. The snake's muscular body, all coil and undulation, detached, slipped from its skin, and left this effigy as long as my arm. It catches dust. Light glows through it. All these skins we've shed, hoping for opacity, the concealed underside, a warning rattle in long grass.
Wonderful. What do you hope readers come away with after taking in some of your poems from this particular book?
I hope these come away with an enthusiasm for poetry, for reading more poetry. As I said, we have marvelous poets here, and our libraries are full of books of poetry, including books of our local poets as well. I hope they write poems. Poems grow out of the things we look at closely, and it does everybody good to slow down and really observe what they see.
Since you have taught writing, I have to ask, do you have a best piece of advice that you pass on to students who want to be writers or poets? Or maybe what is a piece of advice that someone gave you that really resonated?
The work of writing is rewriting. The way the poem comes out in a rough draft is like digging a lump of clay out of the ground. It's really what happens afterwards with the shaping and the very particular choice of words that do the work of the poem. And that doesn't mean just what they mean. It means the way they sound and the effect of the sounds. So there's nothing unintentional in a poem. So if there's one thing that new writers sometimes overlook is we become so attached to what we've written down in the first place that we can't always see what the poem's really trying to do.
Awesome. Well, we've been talking to Megan Anderson Bohegan. She is a Fresno poet and a poetry community organizer here in the Central Valley. Her latest collection of poems is called Vanishing Point, and she will be launching that book this Saturday, February 16th, in the back room of Review Coffee in the Tower District. That'll take place at 7 p.m. again this Saturday. You can find details on Facebook, on the Review's Facebook page, and also Megan Bohegan's. Megan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Monica Velez, reporter Carrie Klein, and our news director Alice Daniel. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Monica Velez. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring Yamilet Rodriguez, a 2019 recipient of a James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award. Watch a video about her work at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.